I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. President Lincoln was assassinated at Ford's Theater on Good Friday, April 14, 1865, and died the next day. This was just a few days after Robert E. Lee surrendered at Appomattox, essentially ending the long and bloody Civil War that killed 750,000 people, 2% of the U.S. population. Our guest, Martha Hodes, read the diaries, news stories, sermons, speeches, and letters written that spring about Lincoln's death for her book, Mourning Lincoln. And she found that the nation was not united in grief. One person wrote, "'Tis the saddest day in our history," while another exclaimed, "Glorious news." We asked Martha Hodes to join us as we mark the 150th anniversary of Lincoln's death. She's a professor of history at New York University and joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Martha Hodes, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Would you say that shock was the dominant reaction? Because we're talking about the first president murdered in office, and we're also talking about something that happened so close after the end of the Civil War.
Yes, absolutely. The major response, or the most pervasive response, was shock. And that included people who loved Lincoln and people who despised Lincoln. But people who loved Lincoln especially wrote in their diaries, wrote in their letters, that it was absolutely stupefying, astounding, amazing. A thunderclap from a clear blue sky is a phrase you often hear. People often invoked strange weather patterns to describe their moods. They were struck with horror. They were struck with grief. They called it a calamity, a catastrophe, a dagger to the heart. All of those kinds of phrases and words conveyed the shock people felt.
Do you think that grief was so profound because so many people in this country had lost someone, either killed or perhaps even more, even wounded from the Civil War?
Yes, just as you said, 750,000 deaths from the Civil War, 2% of the population. Just to translate that into present-day terms, that would mean 7 million lives lost today. So almost everybody knew somebody who had died in the Civil War, whether father or husband, son, brother, friend, or neighbor. People thought of Lincoln in some ways as the last casualty of the Civil War. That wasn't literally true because people kept dying. Soldiers were dying in hospitals and at camp and at home from wounds they'd received. But people thought of Lincoln symbolically. His death was symbolically the last death. And people combined their grief for Lincoln with their grief for their loved ones. And so often in diaries or letters, I would find people writing about Lincoln's assassination and then adding a line like, 2 years ago today, my dear son died in the war.
Mm. What I've found from your book, and there are many things that I learned from your book, is that there wasn't a northern response and a southern response to Lincoln's death. It was a much more complex response than that. And perhaps, you know, we naively think that the country was so evenly divided along those lines, but clearly it wasn't.
Yes, that's exactly right. So in the South, you have white Southerners and black Southerners, and they're fighting on different sides of the war. So Confederates respond to Lincoln's assassination with a certain amount of glee. Partly it's just a relief from the horror of surrender and defeat. Southern African Americans, former slaves, people who have recently been freed, are utterly devastated. And then in the North, most people are Lincoln supporters and most people are overcome with grief, but there is a significant minority of Lincoln's antagonists, the so-called Copperheads. They were the members of the Northern Democratic Party. They had been named after a poisonous snake by their enemies. And they also responded, like the Confederates, with glee at Lincoln's assassination.
As you say, glee, but really, I mean, glee in all its glory, right?
Yes.
Kind of reveling in his death.
Yes, that's exactly right. Confederates are a really interesting case because they do revel in Lincoln's assassination. And they say things like, oh, one soldier wrote in his diary, pity it hadn't been done years ago. Mm. And people write things like, bully for Booth. But at the same time, Confederates are very trepidatious. They're very fearful of what's going to happen next. And in some ways, they consider Lincoln someone who would have been good to them after surrender. I at first thought that that idea that Lincoln was the best friend of the South was something that developed later with a kind of lost cause narrative. But I found that sentiment that very day, the day of Lincoln's death. So Confederate responses are both gleeful for the moment, just for the moment, as a reprieve from defeat, but also fearful in the end. And the Copperheads in the North, they supported a war for union, but they hated a war for slavery. And so their responses to Lincoln were in many ways based in racism and were very joking and jovial. So one man said, for example, after Booth shot Lincoln in the head, he has as much brains now as he ever had. Mm. So those kinds of jokes infuriated Lincoln's mourners.
And for blacks and slaves or former slaves, I'm assuming that they were afraid that there would be a return of slavery.
Yes, very interesting. So African Americans had been very critical of Lincoln during the war because he had been slow to act on emancipation. But Lincoln had been deeply influenced by African Americans, by black abolitionists and their white allies during the war. And of course, he had eventually issued the Emancipation Proclamation. He had delivered the second inaugural address when he was elected 6 weeks before he was assassinated, in which he had stated clearly that the war was a war about slavery. And he had stated in that address that God wouldn't let the war end until slavery ended. So African Americans were devastated, fearful, and the example you gave is interesting. I found a document in which a six-year-old boy in the South asked his teacher, who was a Northern missionary, does this mean we have to be slaves again? And no doubt he was echoing what grown-ups around him had said.
You purposely looked at things that were written at the time, diaries, you know, news stories, letters, sermons, speeches, rather than relying on, the memories or the memoirs that came later. Why did you want the kind of immediacy in response to Lincoln's assassination?
Well, many people have written about Lincoln's assassination have turned to memoirs in order to gauge and determine people's responses. And those are perfectly good sources. But in the course of my research, I came across a number of examples that convinced me that if I really wanted to understand what was going on in the spring and summer of 1865, I was going to have to leave these sources aside. Mm. So the first example that struck me was when Lincoln was assassinated in Ford's Theater, he was carried across the street to a boarding house where he was put in a back bedroom. The White House was too far away, and so they had to pick the closest space. Well, in later years, an impossible number of men wrote in their memoirs that they were the individuals who carried Lincoln across the street.
Oh.
There just weren't enough people to fit around, or wasn't enough room around the body for that to be possible. It wasn't that those people were lying, but maybe they were nearby and they recraft their memories. But the other thing that struck me was occasionally an archival collection would have, say, a soldier's diary. And then decades later, as an older veteran, the man might type up his diary and add in some reminiscences. And so just to give one example, a Union Army soldier who had been in the hospital, and he wrote in his diary, "Lincoln visited the hospital today and passed by my bed," you know, something like that. Then when you read his reminiscence, it's very embellished. "Lincoln shook my hand. He shook the hand of the Confederate soldier next to me. He spoke to all of us." Now, I suppose that's possible that that happened, but it's more likely that the soldier embellished his narrative, and especially because in this case, he was making a kind of a white North, white South reconciliation narrative. In other words, "Lincoln shook my hand and the hand of the Confederate soldier." So those crafted memoirs are just not reliable sources.
And do you also get the kind of rawness of emotion when it's in real time?
Oh, yes, absolutely. In a number of instances, I found what seemed to be the preservation on the page of people completely distraught. So I have a wonderful diary of a woman who's writing, "Lincoln was assassinated, how terrible this is." And in between almost every word, she draws a dash. Mm. And reading it, I realized she was probably crying or sobbing and couldn't continue to write the words. And so she would write these dashes while she was gasping for breath. And that kind of immediacy is what's so wonderful about these sources.
Well, you pick several sources in particular, a couple named Sarah and Albert Brown. They were abolitionists. They lived in Salem, Massachusetts. Sounds like they were pretty well off. And they were, in many ways, at least we read from Sarah, you know, devastated by the assassination of Kennedy. How did you find them, this couple?
Sarah and Albert Brown, abolitionists from Salem, were indeed devastated. While I was conducting my research in the early stages, I was on the lookout for historical actors who I could follow all the way through the narrative. So I needed people whose sources would last all the way from, really, from the Civil War all the way through. I wanted to follow them all the way up through the summer and even beyond. But I also wanted people whose points of view would make for an interesting story. So I found the Browns in the course of my research, and I marked them as possible protagonists because their sources are so extensive. Albert was away working in the South for the Union Army during the war, so he and Sarah wrote long letters to each other, and Sarah kept a diary. And also the point of view, the abolitionist point of view, was a point of view that I wanted to represent in the book, along with its opposite.
Well, and the opposite is a Florida lawyer, a man named Rodney Dorman, I mean, an out-and-out racist. How did you find him?
Well, by the same method, exactly what I was saying. I was on the lookout for somebody who would represent the other end of the spectrum. And Rodney Dorman, who was living in Jacksonville, which was Union-occupied during the war, was what you'd call a diehard rebel. He was a lawyer, very smart, very pro-slavery, very racist, and he wrote reams and reams in his private diary. And so what I had with the Browns and Rodney Dorman were three historical actors who represented two ends of the philosophical spectrum and a great volume of sources that could tell a story and who I could follow these people through all the way.
Rodney Dorman wouldn't even spell Lincoln's name correctly. He spelled it L-I-N-C-O-N, forgetting the L there. I mean, just to sort of show his distaste for the man.
Yes, he spelled the name. At first I thought it was a misspelling, but then I realized this is a very educated man, and he spells very complicated Greek and Roman and Latin words correctly. So he was clearly making a statement, and this is, you can know this also from the context of everything he writes, that Lincoln was a con man, that he was a buffoon and a fool and evil and a monster and a tyrant.
But it also sounds, I mean, it sounds like he wasn't private about his feelings about Lincoln, but many people either felt they had to be private or were more private about their criticisms of the president.
Well, Dorman wrote in his diary, which was a private document, and you can tell from different parts of the diary that every so often he'll walk through the streets of Jacksonville, but I would guess that he didn't voice his opinions in Union-occupied Jacksonville. But you are right, Marty, that some people did not hold back in front of mourners or in front of Union soldiers if they were in the South, and those people paid the consequences. Mm. So Union soldiers in occupied areas were on the lookout for people who were celebrating Lincoln's assassination, and those people were sometimes arrested, sometimes treated with violence by citizens. Copperheads in the North who were voicing their glee at Lincoln's assassination were sometimes tarred and feathered, literally, or driven out of town or warned away. And some of the Union soldiers who didn't like Lincoln were arrested for treason. And the reason given in the documents is that they were considered to be accessories after the fact, which I found a very curious phrase.
Indeed. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Martha Hodes, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. She's a professor of history at New York University, and we're talking about her new book. It's called Mourning Lincoln, and it's how the country reacted to Lincoln's assassination. Happened 150 years ago this month. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, with any questions or comments that you might have. You can also leave a message on our Facebook page, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Martha Hodes. She's got a new book called Mourning Lincoln, and it's how the country responded after the assassination of President Lincoln 150 years ago this month. Let's talk about Mary Todd Lincoln. And as you write in this book, everything sort of about her at that time was poor Mrs. Lincoln, poor Mrs. Lincoln. And one can understand the devastation that she experienced. How did she mourn her husband?
Well, you're absolutely right that many of the diaries and letters I wrote use that exact phrase, poor Mrs. Lincoln. People felt terrible for her. And indeed, she had experienced the trauma of witnessing, sitting right next to her husband when he was shot in the booth at Ford's Theater. Today, we would say she suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm. She had also lost two sons during the war, one in 1859 and one in 1862, little boys. What's interesting about Mary Todd Lincoln's response is that many mourners made the statement that they felt as if the world had come to a halt. But in fact, for most people, that wasn't true. They kept on with their daily lives. For Mary Todd Lincoln, the world really did come to a halt in that she went into the White House. She shut herself up in a bedroom, not the bedroom she had shared with the president. She couldn't stand to be in there. And she did not come out for a long time. She did not attend the funeral in Washington. She didn't ride the funeral train. She didn't attend his burial in Springfield, Illinois. She really was so devastated, she would permit only a few close friends to come in and see her. So she really was deeply, deeply traumatized and unable to face the future.
Which tells us a lot about their relationship, if I can use a very 21st century, or about their marriage.
Well, they did have, the Lincolns had a complicated relationship.
Yes.
And many scholars and many people have blamed Mary Lincoln for being shrewish or for spending too much money. And while some of that may be true, whatever happened to her after the assassination, I think we have to understand in light of what she had experienced in the loss of her husband.
How quickly did the news travel at that time?
I also found that very interesting, Marty. So the Telegraph, of course, felt and really was instantaneous. The Telegraph was the Twitter of 1865. So as soon as Lincoln was assassinated, people ran from Ford's Theater to the Telegraph offices in Washington, and the telegrams began to go out. And then, of course, when the president died the next morning, the same thing happened. Then what would happen was the journalists would come to the Telegraph office, and people would also pick up the telegrams, and then the news would start to spread through newspaper headlines and by the telegram itself. So wherever the telegraph lines ran, people got the news very quickly. So that included, for example, San Francisco. On the morning of Saturday, April 15th, somebody stood on the steps of the telegraph office and read the telegram. And I have accounts of that from diaries and letters. But wherever the telegraph didn't run, it took quite a bit longer for news to spread because people usually had to wait for the delivery of newspapers or by mail for letters that had the news. So there were some parts of the United States, especially the territories, where people didn't get the news for a week or 2 weeks, sometimes a month or 2 months. And overseas, it took 2 weeks to get to England, and then it took until June to get to places like China and Australia.
Is that why the sort of official, what it feels like the official mourning period went on for several months, just because of the time it took to for the news to spread?
Yes. I mean, the most immediate mourning period was the 2 weeks between the assassination and then the burial of Lincoln on May 4th, 1865. But all through that time, at different stages, people in different places were getting the news. And so, for example, I have letters written by the U.S. ambassador to Egypt, and he got the news much, much later, weeks later. And he would write in his letters, "I feel this has just happened right now." Mm-hmm. So he was repeating all the grief and shock that everyone back in the United States had felt such a long time ago.
John Wilkes Booth, who killed the president, he was a Confederate sympathizer. And to be perfectly honest, I did not know this. His original plan was to kidnap the president and hold him hostage.
Yes, that's right. And when the war, when Union victory came, Booth changed his plan. And he and his conspirators decided to assassinate the president. But the most telling piece of evidence we have about that comes from the speech that Lincoln gave on April 11th, so that was 2 days after Lee had surrendered, and Lincoln stood on the White House balcony, and he spoke to a crowd that had gathered below. He spoke to them about his plans for reconstructing the nation. And one of the things Lincoln said in that speech was that he thought, personally, that certain black men should be granted the vote. And he specified black men who had served the Union as soldiers and what he called very intelligent black men, unknown what he meant by that. In any case, John Wilkes Booth, this young Shakespearean actor, was in the crowd that night. He was standing with a companion, and that companion, who was also one of the conspirators, later testified that when Lincoln made the statement about black male suffrage, Booth said, "That's the last speech he will ever make. Now, by God, I'll put him through." And so that was partly the motivation. He was so infuriated. Booth was a white supremacist. He was infuriated by this idea that Lincoln put forth.
And who did they think, if they had kidnapped him, who were they going to exchange him for?
I don't know what they thought was going to happen. And even a better question than that is the conspirators had planned not only to assassinate Lincoln, but to assassinate Vice President Andrew Johnson as well. Mm. And so the question there is, what did they think would happen? Well, the kidnapping and the assassination, what they really wanted was chaos. They wanted the federal government, the Union, to be in chaos. And that might perhaps give the Confederacy a chance to, I don't know, reverse defeat perhaps.
Well, as you say, this Rodney Dorman, the Florida lawyer who was, in fact, quite happy about the assassination of the president, called Booth a great public benefactor.
Yes, and in fact, Booth, the Confederate response to Booth is so interesting. It's another one of these contradictions, because on the one hand, people did write all over their personal writings, like I said, bully for Booth, and we will welcome Booth to the South as a hero. But at the same time, Confederates had another concern. They did not want Booth to be associated with the Confederacy or the Confederate leadership or Robert E. Lee. And so at the same time as they were writing in their letters and journals that Booth was a hero, they were also writing, Booth is a lone madman. He is crazy. He is insane. He is not one of us. Very contradictory. And yet on the same page, in the same diary entry, you would get those kinds of contradictory responses.
And again, that's Martha Hodes, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She's a professor of history at New York University, the author of several books, including most recently one called Mourning Lincoln. And 150 years ago this month, President Lincoln was assassinated. And of course, the country react with shock. And then, as our guest has been describing, with many different emotions to his death. And if you want to join our conversation, again, that email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let's talk a bit about his funeral and then the funeral procession that took about 12 days. You have a piece in the New York Times today about what happened to Lincoln's body as it went from town to town. It came through Philadelphia, for instance. It seems like by the time it got to its burial place, he didn't look particularly presidential.
Yes, that's right. So Lincoln's body was carried after the funeral in Washington, which took place on April 19th. Lincoln's body was carried on a 2 weeks, nearly 1,700-mile journey across the northern states to be buried in his hometown of Springfield, Illinois. And of course, in 1865, the art of embalming was quite rudimentary. And so although doctors had tried to preserve Lincoln, the decay set in quite quickly. And what that meant was that people were very eager for a glimpse of Lincoln's body and Lincoln's face. It was one of the ways to make the assassination seem real after the shock of the news. And so perhaps a million people across the country filed by Lincoln's coffin. I should say that the body was removed from the train at 11 separate destinations for 11 separate cities and their funerals in those particular cities. So there were many funerals for President Lincoln. But as you were saying, Marty, his face began to shrink. The skin began to darken. That's what happened when skin begins to decay. And so a number of the sources that I read, quite a few of the sources that I read, made the point that you were talking about, that he didn't look very presidential. He didn't look, one man said, he didn't look as we expected great men to look. And some people stepped out of the line and said, you know, I'd rather remember Lincoln as I saw him, say, at the second inaugural, or giving a speech with a beautiful smile on his lips, realizing that what they saw in the coffin didn't feel like Lincoln's spirit.
But I'm assuming 150 years ago, people were much more used to seeing dead bodies than we are today.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's an excellent point. People died at home in the 1860s and all in the era of the Civil War. People would... There was no dying in a hospital. I mean, the Union soldiers died in hospitals, but ideally you would die in bed at home. And yet still, bodies were not kept around for 2 weeks. Mm. And so all that time, Lincoln was decaying, and the doctors who traveled with the funeral train would keep repowdering his face, which gave it a very white, pasty look. So it was not what they wanted to see. They wanted a last look at the Lincoln they remembered, their commander-in-chief, their hero, their beloved president, and that's not what they were seeing in the coffin.
You have a really interesting chapter. In fact, it's titled God. And I guess how people interpreted perhaps the war, perhaps slavery, and certainly Lincoln himself as they were living their own faith. Interestingly, he was shot on a Good Friday, died the next day. How were the various interpretations of perhaps Lincoln's assassination interpreted through the lens of God?
Well, people really struggled spiritually, and that was what was so interesting to me. So Lincoln was shot on Good Friday. He died the next day, and the day after that was Easter Sunday. Mm. So, of course, people expect to go to church on Easter Sunday and hear a joyful sermon. And, of course, the ministers had written joyful sermons and had to rewrite them in some way preserving the joy of Easter, but also reckoning with what had happened. People went to church with one enormous question on their minds. Why had God let this happen? Mm. This was just after Union victory, so the victors felt sure that God had orchestrated Union victory, and now they could not imagine why God had taken Lincoln away at this moment. And so what ministers told their congregations, and the ministers were struggling too, by the way, because I read their diaries and letters as well. They tried to make the case that God's will was mysterious, but the fact that he had taken Lincoln away when he did gave greater meaning. Somehow God's plan was more meaningful than human beings could ever understand. And people went home and wrote that in their diaries. This is what the minister said. But they still weren't quite sure, and they were still really struggling with that question.
I mean, was it trying to deify him, or did people come away with this, you know, the sort of right, especially on Easter weekend, the sort of rising from the dead?
Well, Lincoln was deified, and Lincoln was deified, I would say, instantly. I wondered if that was something that happened later. But again, Saturday morning, April 15th, people compared Lincoln to George Washington, although that was something white mourners did and black mourners did not do, since George Washington was a slaveholder. Mm. Then people compared Lincoln to Moses, and then people compared Lincoln to Jesus. And that was, Moses and Jesus were both black and white mourners. And people would write things, African Americans would say things like, next to Jesus, Lincoln is the greatest person who ever lived. So they would, you know, make him maybe one step down, but that comparison was definitely in people's minds and hearts.
We have an email from David. He says, in all the research, was there a point at which people on both sides, North and South, stopped lamenting or celebrating the death of the president and began writing about other topics that would have indicated a quote-unquote moving on? How long did this mourning last?
That's a wonderful question. What I found was that I have a chapter in the book called Everyday Life, and what I found was that Lincoln's mourners continued to mourn, but from the very beginning, without any kind of compunction or self-consciousness, they did continue on with their daily lives. Now, that was partly because they were the victors, and they were also looking forward to the future. The nation had been reunited. They'd won the war. But people constantly wrote about their farms. They wrote about romance. They even wrote things like, we played cards tonight, we went to a show. So people both continued on with everything else they were doing and stopped to express their mourning for Lincoln, and even said contradictorily, the world has come to a stop, even as they kept writing about these other things. But on the other side, it was much, much harder to pick up everyday life where it had left off because Confederates had lost the war. And so their lives were going to be very, very different from that moment forward. And they were much slower to pick up on everyday life and much slower. So their equivalent, Confederate equivalent to the assassination was defeat. And it was much harder for them to move forward from that point.
Because they were still grappling with the fact that they had lost the war.
Yes, and because especially for former slaveholders, their lives were going to be so different. So I have Confederate diaries and letters that express tremendous grief, but not over Lincoln. It's over the loss of the war and specifically the loss of slave property.
Where do you find letters? And I mean, I know you're a historian, and so part of your job is to track this stuff down, but where do you find letters and sermons and newspaper? Well, newspaper accounts probably are easier to find, but how did you find some of these personal documents?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, a lot of readers have asked me what Lincoln archived. Is there a Lincoln archive of his assassination where you found all these letters? Well, the answer is no. What I did was I went around to many, many archives. And some of these are digitized and online, but I took many trips because many sources are not online yet. And I pursued family papers and the papers of people who had fought in the Civil War. And as long as somebody had written and preserved something from the spring of 1865, it was almost guaranteed that someone in the family had written something about Lincoln's assassination, North or South. So to do that, I had to read through hundreds and hundreds of collections, many hundreds more than I used in the book, in order to find and gather all of these sources and tell the story from them.
Are we talking original documents here then?
Yes, absolutely. I held in my hands. I saw with my own eyes the letters, yeah. The diaries. I opened the diaries. I turned the pages. I looked through the letters that have been preserved. I read through them. I read forwards and backwards. And actually, that's one of the reasons that I was able to find out so much about how everyday life continued on, because I wasn't just looking at extracts of what people said about Lincoln. I was also looking at the sentences in between and what they said before they got to Lincoln, what they said after they mentioned Lincoln.
What was the literacy rate at the time? I'm trying to imagine who could write and who couldn't.
The literacy rate was quite high in the Civil War era, highest for white Northerners, not bad for white Southerners. The least literate population were African Americans. And that was a very important factor for me to take into account, because African Americans are absolutely central to this book and to the story of Lincoln's mourning. And so for African Americans, I used different kinds of sources. There were letters and diaries, and I did find as many as I could of those. Some were free African Americans. But I also used letters that black soldiers and African American civilians had written to black newspapers at the time. So they were printed black newspapers with letters from readers. And I also used sources in which literate white people recounted conversations they'd had with African Americans. So, for example, when I talked earlier about the six-year-old boy who asked if he would have to be a slave again, right, now that Lincoln had died, that came from a letter that his white teacher had written back to her missionary association. So it was very important for me to tease out the voices of African Americans in the story and not leave them out, because they didn't leave as many personal sources as did white mourners.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. I do want to talk about Frederick Douglass, who you write about in this book, and that's Martha Hodes. She's a professor of history at New York University. She's the author of several books, and we have been talking about her most recent one. It's titled Mourning Lincoln, and believe it or not, this month marks the 150th anniversary of the assassination of President Lincoln. And you can join our conversation by giving us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Martha Hodes about the many reactions that Americans had 150 years ago when President Lincoln was assassinated. Reactions including shock and anger, grief, fear, glee, satisfaction. It's all included in her new book called Mourning America. Before we get to John Wilkes Booth, there's a question from actually an email from Kevin, who says, in your research, did you turn up any new information on the story of Dr. Mudd? He's the doctor that treated Lincoln. Was he a scapegoat for national mourning or an accessory after the fact?
The book is Mourning Lincoln, not Mourning America. Let me just make
that
correction.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely.
That's okay. I did not turn up new information on Dr. Mudd, because the book is really about personal responses to Lincoln's assassination. So I didn't pursue the facts of the conspirators and the conspiracy, except insofar as it related to people's responses.
You do include two really interesting speeches in your book that Frederick Douglass gave. The first, I believe, was June 1st, 1865, and this was near, I guess, the end of the mourning period for Lincoln. He says, no people or class of people in the country have a better reason for lamenting the death of Abraham Lincoln and for desiring to honor and perpetuate his memory than have the colored people. And he goes on to say that Lincoln was a black man's president. How important was that speech?
Well, Frederick Douglass is such an important character in this drama and in the history of the Civil War. Douglass was not uncritical of Lincoln during the war. He did push Lincoln to be more radical on abolition and on the issue of slavery. But when Lincoln was assassinated, Douglass recognized that Lincoln had come a long way, that he had been influenced by black abolitionists, by Frederick Douglass himself. And Douglass made the point that Lincoln was an honorable anti-slavery man and that his loss was a tremendous loss for African Americans. He used the phrase unspeakable calamity, and that's quite a forceful phrase. Douglass also made the point that slavery would not be abolished until the black man has the vote. That's how he put it. And his point there was that had Lincoln lived, Douglass believed, Lincoln would have listened to African Americans. He would have considered what they needed to do, what he needed to do in order for African Americans to move beyond mere freedom to acquire citizenship, voting rights, land, education. That's not what happened under Lincoln's successor, and Douglas was quite aware of that.
He says, it was my privilege to know Abraham Lincoln and to know him well. I saw and conversed with him at different times during his administration. In daring to invite a Negro to an audience at the White House, Mr. Lincoln was saying to the country, I am president of the black people as well as the white, and I mean to respect their rights and feelings as men and as citizens. I mean, powerful words there.
Very powerful, and a very powerful incident in which, after the second inauguration, Lincoln was accepting people into the White House, and guards attempted to stop Frederick Douglass because he was a black man. And Lincoln saw Douglass at the door. Douglass tells this story in his own autobiographies. And Lincoln said, there's my friend Douglass, and excused himself to help him get past the guards. And Douglass never forgot that.
Something else, and it's such a wonderful metaphor talking about black suffrage. Frederick Douglass says, it was just like Abraham Lincoln. He never shocked prejudices unnecessarily. Having learned statesmanship while splitting rails, he always used the thin edge of the wedge first, and the fact that he used it at all meant that he would, if need be, use the thick as well as the thin. I really like that.
Yes, and what Douglass is pointing to there is something that actually angered Douglass at various points, because he's making the point that Lincoln was a consummate statesman and diplomat, and he didn't very often, if ever, make dramatic moves. For example, when he issued the Emancipation Proclamation, radical a document as that was, it was couched in very legalistic terms. And so Douglass was praising him for something that, while Lincoln had been alive, Douglass had been very critical of.
Did his assassination elevate him? I mean, he is considered to be one of our greatest presidents, and I think that probably would still stand. But he was a martyr as well. And do you think that elevated his status?
It certainly did. The unknown to that question is what would have happened had Lincoln lived, because that, of course, would have determined his reputation for the rest of his life and beyond. So we don't know how Lincoln would have responded, how he would have reconstructed the country. We only have hints here and there. But we do know one thing, and this also comes from Frederick Douglass. We know that Lincoln would have handled Reconstruction in a way much more favorable to African Americans than did Andrew Johnson, his successor. And after the assassination, African Americans went to the White House and petitioned Andrew Johnson. They had a real sense that he was not going to be their friend. And they said to him things like, think about what your noble predecessor would have done. Mm. So they invoked Lincoln specifically as a model for Johnson to follow, and Johnson did not follow that model.
Indeed. Let me get Peter from, looks like, Mount Airy to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Peter. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, I read in some source that might not be reliable, but after Lincoln's death, there were a couple of periods of public hysteria where people got the idea that perhaps his body was not really in the tomb, and that as a result, public pressure required that it be dug up to make sure he was still there. Of course, he was, but I wondered if your guest could speak to that.
Sure, Peter. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. Did people not believe that he had been killed?
Well, that's not formally part of my book, which ends in July 1865, but the caller is correct. I believe that there was a pretty poorly executed attempt to steal Lincoln's body. And then there were moments where the body had to be, the burial had to be reinforced so that nobody could steal it. And if I am not incorrect about this, the body today in Springfield is buried under massive tons of concrete for that very reason.
Oh, really? Really? I mean, were there conspiracy? I mean, there seems like there always are conspiracy theories, but were there particular ones at this time?
Yes. So people wanted to find somebody to blame for Lincoln's assassination. I mean, certainly Booth was the first line of blame, but people who were mourning Lincoln, unlike Confederates who wanted to prove that Booth was a lone madman, Lincoln's mourners did not think that he had acted alone. And they blamed both the Confederate leadership, and then they blamed what they called the Southern system, which was slavery. So they made the point that slavery had murdered Lincoln. But the prosecutor in the trial of the conspirators wanted to prove that the Confederate leadership had been behind the assassination, and he was never able to prove that. There are still scholars and some historians, although it's not the dominant view by any means, who believe there was a larger Confederate conspiracy that's never been proven behind Booth's act.
But not proven, just, I mean, there aren't the sort of documents that could be that smoking gun?
That's correct.
Was Andrew Johnson drunk at his own inauguration?
That is one of the myths or stories that people tell. Some people say he was, and some people say he wasn't. Some people offer the explanation that he had a cold, and so he did what people in the 19th century do when they have a cold, which is they might take a sip or two of brandy or maybe a bottle of brandy. So, yes, he seemed to be under the influence of spirits, but probably not because he was a drunken fool, although that's what people called him who didn't like him.
You say that Andrew Johnson, I think I read this correctly, had a hatred for slaveholders, whereas Lincoln had a hatred for slavery.
Well, that is correct, but this is one of the most interesting points about Andrew Johnson, because he did grow up hating the Southern aristocracy as a poor white Southerner, but Johnson not only hated Southern slaveholders, more than that, he hated black people. And this was the difference between Johnson and Lincoln, and the policies that Johnson executed reflected his dismissal of African-American concerns after the Civil War. And what's fascinating is that Lincoln's white mourners thought that Johnson would be harder on the Confederates because he was known to hate the Southern aristocracy. African-Americans understood very quickly that Johnson would not be their friend and that hating the Southern aristocracy did not preclude also hating black people.
And he hated black people the way black people were hated 150 years ago?
Well, Johnson had been a slave owner. He considered black people inferior. The kinds of responses that he gave to the petitions that black people wrote to him after the assassination were very dismissive. He would even say things like, yes, in the 19th century locution, he would say they were loafers. He would say they were immoral. He would say they should go to Africa. He would say back to Africa. But of course, they had been in America for hundreds of years. So there was no back to Africa for them.
You include in the very beginning of the book that one of the things that got you thinking about how the country mourned Abraham Lincoln was being in New York City on September 11th and being there also in the aftermath of that, you know, horrible, tragic day.
Yes. And in many ways, I trace my writing this book and my interest in the assassination to being in New York during 9/11. And I was very young during Kennedy's assassination. I was 5 years old, so I have memories of that as well. But what we remember as a moment of universal grief and devastation, what I realized when I thought back on 9/11, I remembered it as a moment of universal grief and devastation. And then I went back to some photographs that I had taken. I had walked through the streets of New York on the morning of September 12th, and I had photographed signs that people had written and stuck up and the various shrines that they had made. And there was just as much tension and contention in those signs. So there were people who called for peace, people who called for revenge, people who defaced the signs that called for peace with calls for war, people who scrawled on signs to distrust the media. So it was a moment certainly of shock and grief, absolutely, but also a moment of complication, confusion, tension, contention. And then that's what I realized was also happening at the moment of Lincoln's assassination.
And as you say, you were there. It looks like you witnessed it. And then you went on to teach.
Yes. And that's the other thing that was so interesting to me. I think that partly tipped me off to the continuation, the persistence of everyday life, which I write about in the book. And it also relates to this idea that people felt like the world had come to a halt. And again, when I looked back on 9/11, that's how it felt. But when I thought back on everything I did that day, so for example, I went to Washington Square Park, mounds and mounds of flowers and bouquets had been placed on these makeshift shrines. Well, what did that mean? It meant people were working in the deli where those flowers were sold. People were walking their dogs, feeding their children. Not happily, but everyday life did persist in the same way it did in 1865.
I mean, does that tell us something about just human nature in the face of, you know, shocking and tragic losses?
To some extent, but I think it tells us maybe a bit more about our misconceptions about the effects of devastation, this sense, this visceral sense that the world has stopped turning. which isn't true on a literal level, although I have to add that for 9/11, for people who lost loved ones, the world did stop in a way that it didn't stop for people who didn't experience those losses personally.
As you said, you were a young girl when Kennedy was killed. I think I was something like 14 years old. And for me, anyway, it was just a moment of, and perhaps even like Lincoln in a way, where you just could not believe that a president could be killed. I mean, in certain ways, Lincoln was the first president who was killed.
Yes, absolutely. My memory of Kennedy was walking down the street with the woman who took care of us while my father was at work. And she was a devout Roman Catholic, holding the transistor radio up to her ears and tears streaming down her face. And that's the extent of my memory. But when I connect that to Lincoln's assassination, that's what people did when they heard the news. They left their homes and went out on the street to peer into other people's faces, to see those tears, to see the pale complexions, to see the furrowed brows, to know that other people had gotten the same news and that it wasn't a dream.
Is it also sort of how a country, you know, mourns such a public event?
The public events were meant for unity and for closure. And for some people, they were that, for many people, perhaps. But those public events were also complicated events because Confederates or Union or people who hated the Union or hated Lincoln were staying out of sight. Or if they made any comments, people around them would be enraged. So you have these grand public ceremonies, and then you also have interferences like Lincoln doesn't look very majestic,
right,
or the Philadelphia funeral is a perfect example because it was very late. It was getting dark. Nobody had seen the horse yet with the coffin. People were getting restless. The music wasn't loud enough. People were shouting, "Play up, play up. I can't hear anything." We have a wonderful description by a woman who was there who made the point that by the time Lincoln's body came by, it was so absurd and the carriage was so ridiculously decorated that she almost burst out laughing. So that's what you get from the personal responses. You get not just the majesty, but also the realistic, visceral experiences of the people who were there.
And were you able to follow Sarah and Albert Brown and also Rodney Dorman through, you know, through these events and even into the beyond?
Yes, all the way through. So I was able to follow all three of them through the summer of 1865 and beyond. And Albert and Sarah Brown, typical of many Northern abolitionists, at a certain point became disillusioned with Reconstruction. Some of the racism of white Northerners who had been very, very dedicated abolitionists began to show. They began to tire of everything that was happening in the country. Rodney Dorman never lost his edge of diehard rebeldom. He would write that everything that happened after the Civil War was even worse than the war itself.
We're almost out of time here. You talk about the fact that men wept, and I don't know how unusual, or wept, perhaps that's the correct word. I don't know how unusual that was 150 years ago.
It was very unusual for men to weep in public, and I found so many examples of that that I made it a separate section in the book. So men would write, "I was weeping on the street." Women would write, "I saw my husband wiping the tears from his eyes." Men would write, "I looked in the face of another man and we watched each other with tears falling down our faces." So at the same time that men were very emotional, I also found a counterpart to that in women, which is that they were deeply involved in politics. And while they were writing about the assassination, they were also writing about the war and generals and strategies and tactics. And there was a woman who was devastated by the assassination who wrote, "We felt as if we had voted for him, too." So you have emotional men and political women at this moment of chaos.
Well, it's been such a pleasure, Martha Hotz. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's been wonderful to talk with you.
Nice to talk with you as well. And again, the book is called Mourning Lincoln, and she is a professor of history at New York University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can figure out how to download a podcast of the program. You can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez and Kevin Griffin are engineers for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, with Quinn Lipson. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks so much for joining us.